Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies titled Security and Democracy Today, an Israeli Perspective. Our speaker is former Israeli intelligence chief Ami Ayalon. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Elie Wiesel Center Director Michael Zank.
Now, before I will call on Joe Whipple, professor of the practice of international relations, to introduce our main speaker, Ami Ayalon. I am pleased to invite Mr. Yehuda Yaakov, Consul General of Israel to New England, to offer remarks in remembrance of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin.
Shalom, good evening. It's not just a pleasure, but an honor to be here, certainly to share the same platform with Admiral Ayalon, an Israeli hero. And as somebody, even though I'm a diplomat, spent two-thirds of my career devoted to Israel's security as a diplomat, believe me, I can very much appreciate the accomplishments of Admiral Ayalon through his career. Maybe a couple of words about Yitzhak Rabin's legacy to me as a diplomat. I'll begin by saying when he was assassinated, I was in New York, still a young diplomat, sitting in a hotel room. I was in New York to help our UN mission deal with the diplomatic challenges in the areas of arms control and disarmament. Always a difficult challenge. I was sitting in my hotel room and I saw the reports and alone between the four walls, just started shouting, why, why, why? Not knowing what to do with myself, I went from the hotel to the Israeli consulate in New York on 2nd Avenue and 42nd Street, and I found dozens, became hundreds of people, Americans, Israelis, friends, just kind of hovering around the street, and cars couldn't even move anymore because, as it turned out, a lot of people were just saying, why, to themselves and to others. And we tried to help. We said, what can we do? And you know, the consulate said, well, there's nothing to do. It's already happened. I have in my office, and Admiral Ayalon can attest to that, actually, a picture on my wall. I don't have too many pictures on my wall, but the one picture that I do have is of Yitzhak Rabin sharing a cigarette with King Hussein. You all know that picture. That, to me, not only as an Israeli as a human being, but as an Israeli diplomat, is the kind of peace that I think we strive for, a peace that is not only between leaders or between governments, but one which provides a vision of a better life for the peoples that peace treaty is meant to serve. At the end of the day, the peace between governments is meant to serve the peoples of those governments. And if we fast forward 20 years, and I know quite a bit has been written in the last few days about, as we commemorated that peace between Israel and Jordan 20 years ago on Sunday, we can see that is not only a peace treaty, but a peace which is, at the end of the day, not only solid, but indispensable. Today, nobody can think of a stability and peace in our region without Jordan stable and sustainable. And that's not just on paper, but in the last year we have signed agreements with Jordan to provide desalinated water, to provide gas, and to make sure, to the extent that we can, that life in Jordan is as good as it is in Israel. And I think that was a vision that Yitzhak Rabin brought to Israeli diplomacy, that it's not just signing the paper, but it's also something which will involve relations between countries, between diplomats. And I, over my career, have had many an interaction with Jordanian diplomats and found them to be as committed to peace with the two countries as the Prime Minister and the King were way back when, and to share resources, to share visions, and to protect each other amongst the the dangers and the risks to our security and the people's security, which we're seeing now, which obviously puts Jordan at risk, puts Israel at risk, and we are together in this. Yitzhak Rabin, for me as a diplomat, as an Israeli, brought something else as far as his legacy, and it's also making Israel very much a modern post-industrial nation. People don't even realize that if you go to Israel today and you see this very developed train system throughout the country, that began with Yitzhak Rabin, looking down the road and knowing that you had to prepare the people and the infrastructure of the country for better days. And when Yitzhak Rabin was prime minister, Israel was not yet the economic powerhouse that it is today. It has to begin somewhere. And obviously it began with his time. So that's in a nutshell. I don't want to take the time that Admiral Ayalon deserves. But I did want to share some of those thoughts that as a diplomat, as an Israeli diplomat, our diplomacy would look very different in a very negative way without the contribution of Prime Minister Rabin to our peace efforts and to our diplomacy and to our country. So I thank you very much for coming, and I'll hand over the baton. Thank you very much.
Admiral Ami Ayalon was born in Tiberias, then Palestine, in 1945. Grew up in Magan, a kibbutz. His parents had moved to Palestine in the 1930s. He received his bachelor's degree from Bar-Ilan University in 1980, a master's in public administration from Harvard's John F. Kennedy School in 1992, and to make matters worse, a master of studies in law from Bar-Ilan University in 2010. Admiral Ayalon enlisted in the Israeli Navy in 1963 and volunteered for the commando unit of that Navy. In 1969, he participated in the assault on a fortified Green Island. During this engagement, which in itself would be a worthwhile story for an action film, he was wounded a number of times. The action was successful, and he was decorated with the Medal of Valor, comparable to the Congressional Medal of Honor. He came to command that commando unit and then later came to command the Israeli Navy from 1992 to 1996. Following the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1995, he was appointed head of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence service, where he served until the year 2000. In 2006, Admiral Ayalon was elected to the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, from the Labor Party's list. The following year, he was a candidate for the leadership of the Labor Party, which eventually was won by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He became a member of the cabinet as Minister Without Portfolio and later became a member of the Security Cabinet. He left Parliament in 2009. He is married and has three children. Admiral Ayalon is one of the six former heads of Shin Bet interviewed in the Academy Award nominee documentary, The Gatekeepers. As an aside, if you want to learn something about intelligence, watch The Gatekeepers. During my career as an intelligence officer, I've associated with hundreds of other intelligence officers, both in the Central Intelligence Agency, where I served, and numerous foreign intelligence services from Luxembourg to Mexico, including a bit with Mossad. There are good and some great officers in all these agencies. What separates intel officers is their focus on what was perhaps put best by Hegel, whatever is rational is real, and whatever is real is rational. It certainly separates us most generally from politicians, with the exception of a Rabin, whose focus is so much the achievement and maintenance of power. The other issue broached so well in The Gatekeepers is ethics in intelligence. In the world of intelligence, ethics is not theoretical. Ethics are rather barriers to activities beyond which you cannot go. I cannot imagine a better connection than between the names of Yitzhak Rabin, this memorial lecture, and the Elie Wiesel Center. I cannot imagine a better speaker than Ami Ayalon on the issue of security and democracy today and Israeli perspective. Please welcome Admiral Ayalon.
Thank you very much. And let me start by saying that thank you for your words. How do I know that, although you are much younger than I am, I'm speaking to our Consul General, we belong to the same generation. I remember that years ago I was thinking, what is exactly the definition of a generation? And the more I think of it, I think that a generation, in a way, it's all the people who remember exactly where they were, with whom, and exactly what they did in a specific moment. I remember exactly where I was in Saturday, November 4, 1995, when Rabin was assassinated in the square in Tel Aviv. I remember exactly where I was with whom on October 6, Saturday, 1973, 2 p.m., when we heard the sirens all over Israel and we knew that we are at war. I'm saying it because, in a way, although you are younger, I believe that both of us belong to the same generation. I knew Rabin. I knew him as a defense minister, prime minister. And since next week, we are going to commemorate his assassination. We cannot speak of his legacy without discussing this tragic moment. I used to meet him every week when I was a commander of the Israeli Navy and he was prime minister and defense minister, and we admired him. I used to meet him every week, especially when, the way I see it, we fought together for achieving big submarines for the Navy. I'm saying it because I remember him signing on a letter to Chancellor Kohl, a German chancellor, when he was asking German assistance to build the submarines. And he said, "We shall secure our future, we Israel, shall secure our future only if alongside our effort to achieve peace, we shall reinforce our military strengths." Rabin knew everything about war. He was a fighter. He was a commander. He knew everything about war because when he was a very young commander in 48, he saw the price, the human price, that war demand. When he saw hundreds of his people dying around him during the battle for Jerusalem, or in 1967, he understood the essence of victory when a commander of the Israeli forces, he led Israel to its probably most important victory in the Six-Day War. And he understood probably the sourness of the war when, during the Intifada, as a defense minister in 1988, he understood the limits of military power in the war against terror. Many years before every American president, he told us, when he went to Oslo, he came to the chief of staff, to the general chief of staff, and he spoke to us. And I remember that he told us, and I think I almost quote, "Our response to terror and violence cannot depend on military only. We need all elements of national power to win a battle of wills and ideas." He said it before every American president. We need diplomacy as well. We must not miss an opportunity for peace. If you ask me, this was his legacy. In Israeli eyes, it was a revolution. And because of this legacy, he was murdered in the square. Many years earlier, I was a young naval officer in the Naval War College, Newport, Rhode Island. And I remember that I used to believe that submarines will be the future of naval warfare. So I took a seminar studying submarines. I remember the professor who was previously a commander of a submarine. He came to the auditorium and he showed us several slides. The first one was a slide of a rough sea. The second one was a satellite photograph of the sea. And the third one was a radar screen photograph of the sea. And he said, look, what we are going to discuss now are submarines. Here are the submarines. Of course, no one see any submarines. So he said, this is... In order to see a submarine, we have to use a different sensor. We call it sonar. We have to transmit in a much lower frequency, almost the frequency of the human voice. And we have to use a different software in order to process the data, the information. Otherwise, we know that there is a submarine, but we shall never detect it. I'm saying it because I'm not sure I studied about submarines during the seminar, but I did learn something much more important. What we see around us, the way we understand reality, is not dependent on facts. On the same facts, we reach totally different conclusions. It depends on the paradigm, the conception, the software, the sensor in which we get, we collect, and we process the information. I'm saying it because all what I'm going to tell you is my personal view, very subjective. I assume that based on the same information, a friend of mine could reach totally different perspective. So I do not represent the Israeli government. I represent only myself. And if you will object my views, I will be happy to accept your opinion. I'm not sure I will be persuaded. Anyhow, as I mentioned, October for us in Israel, for my generation, is a very, very important month. It is a very important month because, again, I remember exactly where I was in this Saturday of Yom Kippur in 1973. I was in the kibbutz, just married to my wife. And I remember that 2 days earlier, the head of the intelligence service in Israel promised us, I was a naval officer, that there will be no war. It was a promise. So in the first moment when the sirens started, in the middle of Yom Kippur Saturday, I was surprised. It took me a few seconds to understand that we are at war. And it took me about 3 weeks to understand the magnitude of this war. It was the bloodiest war we ever had in our modern history in Israel. In less than 3 weeks, we lost 2,700 of our friends, 5,700 wounded. And since Israel is a kind of, not a closed society, but everybody knows everybody, I believe that each of us felt that he lost a family member, a friend, a member of our class. So for my generation, it was the event that defined us as a generation. Later, we went to the streets, we replaced our government, we nominated investigation committee, Agranat, our Supreme Court judge. We investigated what we called the paradigm, the conception of our intelligence. We investigated our failure of intelligence, our operational failure. We used to believe that we understand everything. We used to believe that since we understand, we shall never face this kind of surprise again. A year ago, we understood that we understand nothing. Because a year ago, based on memoirs, diaries, protocols, there was another research explaining us something that we did not understand at the time. It is a person named Dr. Igal Kipnis who came to us with a different view of this bloody war, telling us that the major problem with this war was a failure of diplomacy, a political failure, something that we never asked and we never investigated. We understand today that during the years of 72-73, there was a proposition on the table. It was made by Kissinger to Golda Meir. And we understand today that in return to Israeli withdrawal from Sinai to 67 borders, we could get agreed peace with Egypt, with American and international guarantees. It was a former proposal made by Kissinger to Golda Meir and to Sadat. Sadat, the Egyptian president, said yes. Golda Meir, our prime minister, said no. It was not discussed in our cabinet. Only two ministers knew about it, Galili and Dayan. And they decided that the Israeli answer will be no. Years later, in an interview, she explained why she refused. She gave four answers. First of all, the timing was not right. Second, there was no partner. The partner, the Egyptian president, was a very weak partner. We could not rely on this kind of leader. Concessions were too high, and political domestic pressure made it impossible. These were her, you know, her points, why she gave a negative answer. She said in 1973, we should never rely on anybody. We should never believe to anything, not even to a signed peace agreement with Egypt. Moshe Dayan said a year earlier, it is better to have Sharm el-Sheikh without peace than to have peace without Sharm el-Sheikh. I'm saying it because this was the conception. This was the major failure, not the intelligence, not the IDF. Only after the war, after we lost thousands of people, it was Rabin, as the first Israeli-born prime minister, who signed the partial withdrawal from Sinai, and later in 1979, it was Begin who signed the peace agreement. By the way, it is the same agreement that was offered to Golda Meir before the war. And the question that I'm asking as a member of this generation, could we avoid this war? Could we save the life of thousands of our friends? This question was never asked. This issue was never investigated. For my generation, this is the question. Could we avoid this war, or was there a different way that we could choose? If I translate it, 41 years later, after being the commander of the Israeli Navy, the director of the Israeli Shin Bet, a cabinet minister, a father, and a grandfather, after too many wars, too many operations, thousands that lost their lives after this war, how do we understand reality? What sensor are we using to identify opportunities? Or, let me put it differently. It is possible to believe that as a result of so many risks and danger around us, we became blind and we cannot identify opportunities. For me, this is the question of today, not of 73. Let me say something about the reality in the Middle East today. What we call Arab Spring started somewhere in the end of 2010, starting as a very promising spring and became very fast a very cold, dark, long winter. It is a different Middle East. It is a different Middle East, but not the optimistic Middle East that we have been promised by our leaders during the 90s. It is totally different. Some of the characteristics, although it is much too early to try to understand this historic phenomenon, we understand today that this is just the very beginning of a new era. Era that will be characterized by instability. We shall see revolutions and counter-revolutions all around us. It is like an ongoing earthquake. Second characteristics, we understand that at least the way we understand today the Middle East, Huntington was not right. It is much more complicated. What we see is, in addition to clashes between civilizations, is clashes within civilizations. We see a battle between Sunni to Shia, between pragmatism to radicalism, between states to organizations, and between fundamental organizations to radical organizations. Everybody fighting everybody. In a way, most people around us are looking for the source of legitimacy or for the right way of Islam during the 21st century. Third, when we try to predict, again, very risky, but we have to try to understand the future. Political Islam is getting stronger, and we play a major role in the political arena in the Middle East. Economic crisis is deepening. Many governments around us find it difficult to supply basic services. The influence of America in the region is declining, and there is violence all around us. Hundreds of thousands are dying in war and violence. Others are becoming war refugees. And there is a huge, dramatic change in the division of political power. All the governments, all the leaders are weaker, and the street is much stronger. So if we try to understand where are we heading in the Middle East, the street will define our future, much more than the leaders. What are some of the implications for Israel? First of all, the traditional strategy, if we try to understand it in retrospect, that was based on the concept of there is a cornerstone of a pragmatic player. In the past, it was Iran during the 50s, the 60s. Later, during the 80s and the 90s, it was Egypt, Sadat, and later Mubarak. This idea of a kind of a relatively pragmatic coalition collapsed, or at least is shaking, does not exist anymore. Second, traditional diplomacy is invalid. The diplomacy that was based on the assumption that leaders have the authority to represent their people, they can meet in secret places, coming back to us, promising us no more war, no more bloodshed. And later, they will have the power to execute what they signed on, does not exist anymore. We understand that the street will not accept it. We shall not accept it. We shall not, we, even in Israel, there is domestic opposition everywhere. And it is much more powerful than 20 years ago. In the reality of today, we could not sign a peace agreement with Egypt or with Jordan. What shall we do? There is a term that we call public diplomacy or civil diplomacy. No one knows what it is. In the academia, we are trying to create this concept. But we understand that in a way we are moving from a retail diplomacy to a wholesale diplomacy. Sorry, from wholesale diplomacy to retail diplomacy. In a way, we shall have to negotiate with every person in the street if we shall ever reach a point in which we shall have to sign an agreement on our side. Every government will have to deal with the opposition. We shall not be able to sign agreement with the Palestinians without discussing, speaking to the settlers. They will pay the price. We send them. And they feel that we are betraying them. On the Palestinian side, refugees. So it will become much more difficult and much more complicated. The Middle East, to outside spectator, it's like to sail in the middle of a hurricane. In my language, it is a huge storm. The whole state system is threatened. We feel, as Israelis, like we are sailing in a multicentric storm. Waves are coming from all directions. On top of it, when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian relations, especially after Defensive Shield, it was one of the longest operations that we had against terror. We lost 72 people and 2,500 wounded. Palestinians lost more than 2,000, many of them civilians. 11,000 Palestinians became refugees. Sorry, wounded. Between half a million Palestinians became war refugees, homeless. Both sides claim victory, but all of us deep down understand that we are far from winning. All of us, on both sides. We count the time for the next round of violence. in the eyes of the Palestinians, for us, is something that we find difficult to understand. Hamas became stronger as a result of this war. Abu Mazen, the pragmatic leader, became weaker. He is considered to be, in the eyes of the Palestinians, Israeli collaborator. If nothing will happen, this will be what the Palestinian will do in the next 6 months. After the midterm elections in America, they will approach the Security Council demanding a resolution, demanding Israeli withdrawal, the 67 lines, immediately, not more than 2 years. They said it already. They will be ready to negotiate along the lines of 67. They even accept the notion of swap, exchange of territories. If America will veto, they will immediately approach the International Court of Justice in Hague. So the scenario is isolation, sanctions, and violence. This is what they plan. They do not rely on America. They feel that they are isolated. They cannot trust anybody. So they decided for unilateralism. This is the way they understand unilateralism, and this is what they plan to do. So the question for Israel, while we are sailing in this storm, can we identify opportunities? We learn in every business school that in every crisis there is an opportunity. Can we identify it? My answer is we do not have the luxury of not. It is in our hands. If we learn something from Rabin's legacy, it is in our hand. By the way, his last words in the square, he did not know how to sing, but they sang together with the crowd the song of peace. And he said his last words, "Don't tell the day will come. Bring the day." This is his legacy. So the question, what can we do in order to move forward to a reality of two states, which is the only reality in which Israel can preserve its identity as a Zionist state, which means Jewish democratic society. In order to empower pragmatism and to stop radicalism, in order to empower those Palestinians who believe in the reality of two states, and to stop the power of those Palestinians who believe in violence and terror, we have to identify opportunities. We have to see that this reality that I just described create a very strange but new alliances. We have to see that on a common denominator of fear from radicalism, terror, there is a potential pragmatic axis. Start in Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates. They are supported by the Arab League and the Arab League decision with the idea of fighting radicalism and creating a Palestinian state. We have to see that this is the interest of the international community to empower this potential coalition led by Egypt, with the support of America and Europe. And most important, we have to listen to the Egyptian president who told us just 2 weeks ago, November 12th, in Cairo, during the conference in which they discussed the rehabilitation of Gaza after Defensive Shield, he tells us relations with the Arab world will begin by making peace with the Palestinians. In a way, he is telling us that the road to Arab capitals passes through Ramallah. For Israelis, it is strange because we believe that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a minor issue in the Middle East. But it is not important what we think. It is not important even what the Arab leaders think. What is important is what the Arab street in Amman, in Cairo, everywhere, in Istanbul. And since the Arab street or the Muslim street will shape the future of the region, they, their leaders, are listening. They understand that to show progress on the Israeli-Palestinian track became precondition to the formation of this pragmatic coalition, whether we like it or not. In order to do it, we have to change the way we see reality around us. Politically, we have to understand the potential of creating new alliances. We have to understand that a unity government of Hamas and Fatah, led by Abu Mazen, as long as they accept quartet decisions, international formal decisions, is in our favor. Not the way we did it before. It is a great opportunity because it empowers pragmatism, it empowers Abu Mazen, and it can weaken the Hamas. We have to see in the declaration of Palestinian state in the UN a huge opportunity. If our future is two states, we have to support everything that brings us closer to reality of two states. By the way, I'm not a historian, but I do not know many cases in which a state was created as a result of a negotiated process. This is not the case of Israel, by the way. It is a great opportunity, and it is in our favor because it will make it much easier to negotiate the very sensitive issue of Palestinian refugees. It will make it much more difficult for them to demand the return of their refugees into our state. So it will make negotiations a little bit easier, and it will be very, very difficult. We have to understand that the Arab League decision, April 2002 in Beirut, was probably the major victory that we, Israel, achieved since the creation of our state. For the first time, the Arab world accepted us along the lines of 67, by the way. We understand today that they even accept the notion of swap, exchange of territories, by parameters of demography, security, and contiguity. They accept the idea that Palestinian refugees shall return into Israel only if Israel will accept it. I don't think that we shall accept it, but this will be negotiated. It is the first time that they recognize Israel, not only de facto, but de jure. This is a new reality. And we have to see it as a great opportunity. We have to understand that the first step can be and should be the rehabilitation of Gaza as a process under three conditions: to open crossings only if it will be controlled by Abu Mazen and his pragmatic forces. Second, the rehabilitation itself will be controlled and monitored by Abu Mazen and the international community. And third, we have to open or resume negotiations based on Quartet resolution and the Arab League decision, because it is based on something that even those of us who are not happy are ready to accept. Not because too many Israelis believe that Palestinians deserve it, because we understand that for us, this is the only way to preserve our democracy as long with the Jewishness of our society. In parallel, and it is not less important, we have to act independently on the ground in order to create reality of two states. For example, it is time for us to bring back those settlers who are living beyond the security fence and wish to return. We know, according to our polls, that about 30% of them would do it tomorrow. We sent them. They were our pioneers, and we decided to build the fence. In their eyes, they are living outside the fence. In Judaism, it means a lot to live outside the fence in a way they feel expelled from the community. They deserve something better. Reality of two states is not only an Israeli interest. It is a vital interest in order to preserve our democracy. There is a difference between 1973 and 2014. After 41 years, the threat analysis is totally different. The region is less stable, risks are much higher. But the questions are the same questions. Do we know or can we identify opportunities? Are we using the right sensor and the right software in order to understand the reality around us? Many ministers in our government today will tell you that the timing is not right, that the partner is too weak, that concessions are too high, and domestic pressure will make it impossible. So the question, have we learned the lessons of Yom Kippur? It's too early to tell. But the question is relevant today more than ever in the past. Let me tell you something about sailors. I used to sail many years. Sailors are not very clever. But there is a great advantage because our wisdom is very simple. You don't have to study in BU in order to understand us. Yes, we are sailing in a storm. and the weather is very rough. But it will be a huge mistake to blame the wind or the waves. It will not help us. Every sailor will tell you that there is something that we control, not the wind. We control the steering of the ship and the sails or the engine. And in the end of the day, we know that the course of our vessel will determine whether we survive this storm or not. It is in our hands. And again, the last words of Rabin was, "Do not tell the day will come. Bring the day. For me, this is his legacy." Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by former Israeli intelligence chief Ami Ayalon. Our lecture was titled Security and Democracy Today, an Israeli Perspective, and was presented by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Elie Wiesel Center Director Michael Zank. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.